Okay. Bist du bereit, deine Karriere auf die Überholspur zu setzen? Denn das Speed Recruiting Event der Service Plan Group am 30.04. im House of Communication in München bietet dir dafür die perfekte Gelegenheit. In einem kurzen Talk hast du die Möglichkeit, verschiedene Agenturen und deren RecruiterInnen mit deinem persönlichen Elevator Pitch zu überzeugen. Ob du eine kreative Visionärin bist oder eine ambitionierte Bewerberin, Serviceplan lädt dich ein, diese einzigartige Chance zu nutzen. Erhalte tiefe Einblicke in die dynamische Arbeitswelt der Serviceplan Group und knüpfe wertvolle Kontakte. Lerne aus den Erfahrungen anderer und stell dich der Herausforderung des Speed Recruitings. Also, warum warten? Gib deiner Karriere den Turbo Boost, denn sie verdient es, und melde dich jetzt zum Speed Recruiting bei der Serviceplan Group in München an. Den Link mit allen Infos zum Speed Recruiting findest du in der Beschreibung dieser Folge.
I don't want to talk about advertising anymore. Let's change the subject.
Okay. Ezra Gülman is a Berlin-based artist and designer, originally from Turkey. Well, actually, when we met, she had just ended her very successful design career to be able to spend all of her time on her art. But that was a topic that we did not talk about while the tape was rolling, since it wasn't quite official yet. But I think you can hear in our conversation that her career in advertising is something that she had already kind of said goodbye to in her mind. Ezra has won many, many prizes during her time in big agencies, and she has worked with the biggest clients you can imagine, like Coca-Cola and McDonald's. And during all that time, what made her work so special was the same thing that comes out in her art, and that's her humor. She has a way of repackaging complex and sometimes touchy topics and ideas and showing them in a witty and poignant way. And that's also what had attracted me to her work. Actually, it took me a few months to convince her to come on the show because, as she said herself, she sometimes tends to overthink things. But I'm very happy that I persisted and that she finally said yes, as I really, really enjoyed our talk. By the way, we met at the art gallery Heavyweight in Berlin, where she was part of a group show at that time. I feel I should mention that since I butchered the name during the episode more than once. So it's Heavyweight. And in case you haven't subscribed to the podcast yet, now is the perfect time. Personal and very honest conversations with your favorite artists and designers once a week for free, straight to your podcast app. And now I give you Ezra Gülman. Okay. Are you feeling ready for this?
Yeah, let's see.
Yeah.
But we can also stop sometimes. Oh. You don't want to be busy with this cutting thing.
I usually don't cut. Really, I just let it run through. It's, I mean, it's just a conversation, right? I mean, if you say something really stupid, we can cut it out, but
okay.
I don't think you will. Okay. I think you should be fine. we are sitting here in a gallery. What was the name of the gallery?
I don't know how to spell it. Can you please ask Manuel?
HVW8,
but I'm always thinking it's like heavy eight. Shall we ask? Manuel?
I will. Manuel.
I think it would be great if we pronounce it right.
I feel already bad about it, so I will put it in the intro completely perfectly. So he'll be happy with it. But so what's the deal here? What kind of exhibition is this?
Okay, so this is a gallery actually like from Los Angeles, but they also have a gallery in Berlin, and it's a group show, including, like, it's a female artist from all over the world. So it's a group show. Its theme is Where Are We Now? I mean, the title of the show is Where Are We Now? And it's going to be open for 2 weeks. And it's just like, yeah, diverse artworks are, like, included. So
how did you come to be a part of it? Did somebody ask you, or did you organize it, or what's the...
Are we in now?
Yeah, yeah. We're doing it already. We're already way in.
Manuel actually asked me to be part of it. I mean, I have known him since I moved to Germany. And yeah, he just invited me to be part of this exhibition.
Okay. Your artistic side, you lead this double life. You have your artwork, mm-hmm. which is why I know you. I stumbled over your work. We talked about it earlier through Forward Festival. I don't know when it was. But so then I found your Instagram account, and that is full of your artwork. Mm-hmm. But if you dive into your bio a little bit, I can also find out that you've been working at some pretty big agencies for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And before that, you worked in academia, actually, right?
Yes. I did after I graduated from university. Actually, I studied interior design.
Interior design?
Yeah, in a fine arts faculty in Istanbul.
Uh-huh.
Actually,
Are you from Istanbul itself?
You know, like, it's also, like, really interesting. It's a Bauhaus école, and the school was founded by German architects who kind of was exiled from Germany.
Really?
You know, yeah, all these Bauhaus professors, uh-huh. they went to the States, and but some luckily came to Istanbul and Turkey. And, yeah, they founded this university. It's a Bauhaus school, and before that university, I studied American literature, culture, something. And then my family was not really okay that I'm going to study in a fine arts university. Mm-hmm. So that's why I said, okay, then I'm going to study interior design, because it is something I could convince them. Because
it's in practical.
Turkish, it is like interior architecture. Mm-hmm. Because the architecture as a name, it was more like sexy for my family, of course, like rather than me being just an artist, you know, uh-huh. fine artist. And then this is how I convinced them to change my school. And then when I was studying interior design, I met graphic design, and then I saw that actually it is more me, like mm-hmm. Doing something more two-dimensional, a bit more like around communication. So this is what I found more suitable for me. But I finished my school.
How long was it? Probably like four years. 4 years?
Yeah.
But when did you know that you were more attracted to graphic design?
Yeah, actually, to be honest, when I was young, if someone had said like graphic design, I would have thought it's like this graphics, like the statics that, you know, like this. Mm. I didn't know that it's like, I was not really aware of that department in the university. Mm-hmm. So for me, it was like, yeah, I was doing always illustrations, but I didn't have any idea that I could have been able to study in illustration or graphic design. I was just not aware of it, mm-hmm. seriously. And then, yeah, when I was studying, then I'm like, oh, wow, this is cool. And then I was always like making illustrations, and then I was trying to meet graphic design teachers, professors, and I was like trying to be friends with them. I was showing them my works all the time. And when I was like designing a furniture, I was more into making the poster of it, the logo design. But I also enjoyed like making, designing furnitures. So for me, it's like, you know, if you're a designer, if you're a creative, you just want to do everything. You want to do furniture, you want to do logo, you know, it's like, I don't see them really different from each other, to be honest. And I think maybe it's also Bauhaus to teach you to this, you know. Mm-hmm. And you know, so many architects, they're also like designing typefaces, things like that. So I was not the only one who was like...
It always goes both directions, right? So many architects. I mean, I forget who it was. It wasn't Mies van der Rohe, I think. One of them wasn't actually an architect. He never got his license. I don't know if it was Mies van der Rohe or Le Corbusier, but one of them couldn't actually legally make the plans because he wasn't trained as an architect. So that was pretty funny.
Yeah, so then, anyways, then after I graduated, I said I want to be an academic. I don't know why. And then, yeah, I did it. I was teaching like 3 years mm-hmm. in the university. I was teaching basic design. Mm-hmm. But I was super young. I was like 22 years old mm-hmm. or something. And I was like almost the same age with my students. I mean, it was nice. But at some point, I was like, I also want to be part of a creative agency and to work with other creative people who would inspire me. I was not ready yet to inspire young people. I was already young and not, you know, experienced enough mm-hmm. in the creative field. So I said, no, I want to work somewhere. Then I started like looking for a space for me. And I did some internships.
Sorry, if I may interrupt you. I mean, you say you don't know why you did it, but I mean, to teach and stay in academia, I mean, that's a decision, right?
Yeah, it's a decision, yeah. So. I don't know. I just wanted it. It's still in me. I still want to give some classes now again. Mm-hmm. I like to inspire people and also teach and share my, you know, knowledge with young people is mm-hmm. something. I'm also like elder sister of two brothers. Maybe I mean, maybe it's in me. I like it so much, but I was so young, and then I realized I like it, but it's a bit too early for me. Mm-hmm. It was an early achieved goal, you know, happened early, by mistake. And then, but also, I also moved to Germany because I was together with someone and he wanted to live in Germany, and he asked me to go to Germany with him, and I said yes. And then, yeah, I also like left the school. I went to Germany with him, so we moved to Frankfurt together. And I was crying every day, like the first 6 months, because I didn't have a working visa. I was an academic, and after, like, a week ago, you're an academic, and 1 week later in Germany, you are a jobless person, and mm-hmm. you are not allowed to work. And I was really like, I'm like, what did I do? You know, like... all my friends are already working in agencies. They have a career. I have nothing. Am I an illustrator? Am I a designer? Who am I? I was really like crying all the time and cooking for my husband, like for the 6 months in Germany. But then I started at Ogilvy Frankfurt as a design practicant.
You got your working visa, and then you applied specifically to Ogilvy, or were you just spreading it around, seeing where you could work?
I also, yeah, I mean, my ex then was also working at Ogilvy, and he said this design department is actually perfect for you, because I wanted to work in an advertising agency. I also did an internship at DDB in Istanbul, and then I liked the idea of like being with other creative people. This is the best thing about creative agencies, because then you are surrounded by other really inspiring people. Because in architects' offices, it was a bit different. Mm-hmm. So I really enjoyed my time at DDB Istanbul. Then I was like, yeah, I want to be part of this kind of place, you know, with other art directors, copywriters. I really liked it. And then, yeah, it was already in my mind to start in advertising. But I was also not a typical advertising creative. So that's why the design department in the Frankfurt office was perfect for me. And yeah, this is where I started as an intern. And after a couple of months, I got my first job as a junior designer, art director there. And then, yeah, this is how my creative in the advertising world career just started. Like, it was almost 9 years ago.
Oh, yeah. And so you had basically your whole design career at pretty big firms, right? I mean, you said DDB, then Ogilvy. Ogilvy. I never know
Ogilvy,
it.
Ogilvy, yeah.
I can never remember.
It was Ogilvy and Mather. Now it's just Ogilvy. It's coming from David Ogilvy, you know.
Surname. I mean, he's a big art collector as well. Yeah. So, but I always read his name, but I very, very rarely hear it pronounced. Mm-hmm. So I always struggle with that a little bit, to be quite honest.
I'm sure I pronounce it wrong as well, but no worries. We understand each other.
At least it's the two of us then. But so you had all of your career and in big firms like that. So was it a very straightforward career? Were you just being promoted and promoted and promoted, or what was over 9 years?
Yeah, I know. It feels like it happened by mistake. This is what I always say, because it's the joke, of course, but I was never aiming to be, now, you know, I work as a design executive officer. I never aimed to be like this, like working in this, under this title. Mm-hmm. I even didn't want to be a creative director. Mm-hmm. I always was like, I just want to be a good designer. Mm-hmm. An art director, sometimes they call it. It's still a discussion if it is an art director, designer, whatever.
We always so just let's make say these
creative. Yeah, I just wanted to be creative because I am a creative. I can also do like furniture design, interior design. I did a set design. Like I worked in a movie in Istanbul as an art director, and I was designing the whole set there. So it's like I just see myself as just as a creative, and this is what I just wanted to maintain actually. But when you have these offers, you just can't say no. It is the game of this.
It is a game, but
yeah, of course, game. Because if you don't accept this role, it means someone else is gonna be your boss. Just because of that, you say okay. But it's not like. But actually, we all know. But still, we should be aware of the fact that it's another role, like managing other people. It's something really else, you know? It's not really creative anymore. So it requires different responsibilities.
And a different skill set as well.
Different skills, exactly.
Yeah, but I mean, you were already teaching before, so did that help you when you started actually working with leading teams?
Yeah, when I work with like young creatives, I also do give workshops. And then I feel like really comfortable with it. And normally I'm never comfortable with anything. I'm always nervous. And if I'm always like questioning myself if I'm doing it right or not. Mm-hmm. But when I do give workshops or like work with other young creatives, I always feel really comfortable. I'm like, how come that I'm that comfortable? But then I realize, maybe because I was teaching like 3 years in this school. It's, you know, it's maybe in my... genes now, I don't know.
Yeah, it's something you learned very early
on.
Yeah,
now I know it. Yeah, I'm really comfortable with it.
But can you lead me a little bit through that big agency career? I mean, because you arrived in Frankfurt, yeah? Mm-hmm. But I think your next stop was in Amsterdam, right?
Between Frankfurt and Amsterdam, there is this Istanbul adventure. Because, yeah, we made a really terrible mistake, like going back to Turkey. And then it was a really terrible 1.5 years for me. After living in Germany, in Frankfurt, going back to Turkey was not a good decision.
Why?
Because the life quality, like, it's just terrible. I mean, comparing to Germany.
Even
I mean,
in Istanbul.
It is my home country. Of course, there are some things that I feel comfortable with. But in general, life in Istanbul is really, really challenging. Like the working hours, the traffic, people, like it's so stressful, so chaotic. And you know, I live in Berlin, and people from like other cities in Germany, that you find it super chaotic, right? Berlin,
for me,
it's like
that, yes,
it's like a village. It's like the most peaceful city in the world comparing to Istanbul. And even with Amsterdam, to be honest, Amsterdam also sounds like really nice and peaceful, but I don't know. It was also a little bit chaotic for me. It's super small and I don't know. I love Berlin so much and I feel like really peaceful. And
but do you think it might be more your life circumstances than the city itself? Because like you said, I'm from Munich. Yeah, so Berlin is the big city for me, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, Munich, that's a village right there. And but I do like big cities. I mean, Athens or Bangkok, I mean, I love it, but it gets a little bit too much for me after a while. And Berlin has kind of that vibe, like Athens or something like that. It's much more going on, and there's something going on all the time. I mean, we had a coffee earlier, and there were like 17 adventures in just having a coffee, basically. And then Amsterdam, on the other hand, seems really quaint and quiet to me. I mean, it's quite charming. I mean, completely different world from Berlin, I find.
Yeah, it is, but... Yeah, I don't know. The whole architecture and these narrow streets, and it's so touristy, and it is chaos for me.
Okay.
You know, like it's not... I mean, the life in Amsterdam was also super easy and nice, I have to admit. And the working hours were like super friendly, amazing. But I don't know. Maybe it's also the energy of the city.
Yeah,
it's really. I'm a really like spiritual person as well. I feel this energy from people, city, So I think in Berlin is the most peaceful city for me so far. Yeah.
And so when you went to Turkey, I mean, that was a year and a half. So what did you do for work there then? Did you, another big agency or?
Yeah, I worked for Ogilvy again. Like mm-hmm. I worked for Ogilvy since I started at Ogilvy Frankfurt, then Ogilvy Istanbul, then Ogilvy Amsterdam. Mm-hmm. And I was an art director and designer at Ogilvy Amsterdam as well, like two more years. And then since 2017, like it's going to be 5 years this December, next month actually, I have been working and living in Berlin.
Mm-hmm. I've never been a part of a big agency. I used to work, I mean, way in the beginning of my, I mean, good, I'm putting this in air quotes, but my career, yeah. I used to work in small agencies, and I realized that I wasn't really the type of person to work in an office like that. So I stopped it very early. But I always wondered, when you're part of a big agency like that and you want to move to a different city, is that an easy process? Do you just go to your bosses and say, like, look, guys, I need a change of life and I want to go somewhere else. Can you put me in another office? Or how does that work?
I mean, this is how it worked for me, actually. In Istanbul, I was, like, really desperate. And then, I mean, it was not like, yeah, put me there, but it's like you have this network, right? And mm-hmm. if you do good job and then people know you from other agencies, for example, Dare from Ogilvy Amsterdam, the CCO of Ogilvy Amsterdam, was a big fan of my work already. When I asked him that I want to come to Amsterdam, he was more than happy to, you know, to hire me. So it was... I think it's the power of networking.
Yeah, but on the other hand,
but it's not something like, oh, okay, I'm gonna change my city now. Uh-huh. You know, Ogilvy, London, now give me a job. Of course, it doesn't work like that. But of course, when you have a good work on your portfolio, then it's easier for you to reach out these people mm-hmm. via network.
But I assume all your colleagues at the place that you're leaving probably weren't too happy about you leaving, right?
I mean, yeah, sure.
One wins, one loses, basically.
Exactly. It could be also a bit like mm-hmm. this between them, you know, between two offices. But, yeah. They were all understanding, because it was not like choosing one office over the other office. It was more like changing the countries. Mm-hmm. So I changed like 4 countries. Like I have worked and lived in 4 different countries. It was not just office or city. It was changing countries. Then no one has something to say about it.
So they understand it as well then. That's mm-hmm. nothing personal. Okay.
Exactly. When it is not something personal, then they're okay.
Mm-hmm. How long were you in Amsterdam?
2 years.
2 years. And then you just didn't feel the city, and so you were looking for another city, or did you come to Berlin specifically because of, I don't know?
Yeah, for me, Amsterdam was over after 2 years. I was like, okay, what am I going to do here? Uh-huh. And I was not really satisfied with my work, like career there. And I also broke up from my ex, and then I just wanted to start a new life, and Berlin is one of the best cities to do it, like just to start a new life, I think. And then I got an offer from Heimat, Matthias, and Heimat was one of my favorite offices in my list that I would like to work for. Then I couldn't say no, and then I came. So
are they related in some way to Ogilvy, or are they?
No, not at all. But Matthias, my ex-boss, used to work for Ogilvy Frankfurt. So this is how.
Okay.
So actually, he first offered me this junior art director role like 9 years ago. So he knew of me and my work. So, and I was already in his list, and he was looking for a senior art director. And then he asked me to, if I am going to be interested in Berlin. And I said yes. And then I just moved.
It's funny how that works. I mean, you already said networking is the big
yeah.
thing, right? But so he was looking at you already as a junior designer 9 years earlier. And then,
and then he promoted me as a head of design, you know, like 2 years ago. So it was from junior art director to head of design. And yeah, Matthias just, yeah, knows the whole adventure of uh-huh. my career. And then, yeah, I started a different agency again, so...
But I think always it's some people don't realize how close-knit this whole community is, kind of, right? I mean, you mm-hmm. will always run into the same people again throughout your career. And I think it's so important to, I mean, first of all, be just a nice human. Yeah, I mean, and also not to burn any bridges, because I mean, you will, all of a sudden, you will meet the same people again that you met 9 years earlier. Yeah, and from Berlin. So, how long have you been living in Berlin now? Six years? No.
5 years.
Five years. And so you went to Heimat first here.
Yeah.
And how long did you stay there?
At Heimat?
Mm-hmm.
Four years.
4 years.
Yeah.
And was that where you did the, I mean, you did quite a lot of work with, I mean, big companies like McDonald's and Coca-Cola.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, yeah.
And a lot of the things that, that you show nowadays is from that time as well, right? Like that, that McDonald's.
Yeah, McDonald's, for example, is from Heimat. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And ADC, Germany,
mm-hmm.
ADC festival campaign, Bloomy Days. And Coca-Cola is from Ogilvy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I love that. I mean, we're going to talk about your artwork as well, of course. I mean, because since that's the bigger part of your life nowadays, I would say probably.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why I'm like, I don't want to talk about advertising anymore. Let's change the subject.
Okay. But the last thing I want to say about it is that I love how in all of that work, I mean, I don't know all of that work. I haven't seen that much of your work. But the work that you show from those days are, there are a lot of similarities to how you approach your artwork now.
Yeah, which is like, exactly.
There's a lot of puns and clever ideas where you repackage things and visuals and stuff like that.
Yeah, I do communication art. So, and also like the playfulness, the simplicity, the idea, the humor.
Mm-hmm.
It is me. You know, I use this in my commercial work, in my daily work or artwork. It is this. It is coming from the same soul, from the same brain. So I also don't see much difference between the artwork that I do, like how I'm approaching these works. It's the same because in my artwork, the brief is coming from my frustrations in general. If I am angry with something, or if I am sad about something, or if I am frustrated by something, then I sit and do something about it, and then it comes out as an artwork.
Mm-hmm.
With my commercial work, there's already a problem because the client is asking something from you, and there's a problem that they ask you to solve it in a creative way. So, of course, it is easier because there's already something to solve, and plus budget. And but the style, like the, when I say style, like the humor, the simplicity, playfulness, whatever, like I do, it's still the same, that I use the same way of like creating these works.
But I imagine that it's actually kind of easier to do your own work just because there's, like you said, there's this intrinsic wish, you kind of feel like frustration or something and you want to
communicate. Yeah, of course, it's easier.
It.
Yeah.
So you're already kind of driven, right, to do it by yourself.
Yeah, it's amazing. Then you have no client to give you feedback.
You don't have to keep them happy.
Yeah, there are no meetings included. It's perfect. Yeah, it's like, I think art, creating art is like a dream for a creative, because then you're like, but it's also like tricky because when you're 100% free, because we are used to getting briefings, mm-hmm. feedbacks, you know, when you're 100% free, then it's like, you know, what am I going to do? Or if it is good or not, because I have no feedbacks from anyone, you know, it's not like commercial work. You're more free. So it has both good and bad sides, of course, but I'm used to that now.
Mm-hmm. How long... maybe that's a stupid question. I assume you've...
I love stupid questions.
I wanted to ask, when did you start with the art? But then again, I mean, you already said that you did illustrations and stuff when you were a child, right?
Yeah, since I was... I mean, actually, my primary school teacher thought that I was going to be an artist. Like, he was writing that... it is written on my book, you know, like these memory books.
Mm-hmm.
Like after you are finishing your first grade in the school in Turkey, memory. I don't know how is it called, but it's like memory books that your teacher, your friends are writing something about you.
I think you mean like every kid has one, and but it's a private thing, and then you give it around. Like,
no, but it's a book.
Yeah, yeah.
We are really printing it.
Oh no,
it's
I don't know.
It's like an album.
Uh-huh.
After you finish your first primary school, mm-hmm. when you are around 10 years old, I don't know, 11, whatever, you get this book. And it's included some notes from your friends and your teacher.
Okay.
Everyone. Now I'm like reading back. Like they're writing for Esra, 11 years old Esra, that she's going to be an artist. So it was already there, of course. But in Turkey, you know, it's like this in everywhere in the world, I know, but it's really difficult to convince your family to study fine arts, right? So they are like, yeah, do it as a hobby, but then you should have a real job, right?
Yeah.
It is this.
I mean, job. And I do get it. I mean, because becoming a successful artist in any regard, so I mean, that you can actually make money from it and live off of it. I mean, that's like being a rock star, right? I mean, that is
exactly.
Like, there's so few spots for that, basically.
Exactly. So that's why we are all keeping our daily jobs, right? But yeah, some just do it. They just like afford their lives just being an artist. I think it is the goal. But yeah, I was not courageous enough to be just an artist. That's why I was like trying to convince my family to study architecture at least. So it took me years to say that I am an artist. That, you know,
mm-hmm.
And I think in the end I did enough jobs and I opened like 3 solo shows and I was part of many group shows and people started to call me artist. Then I said, okay, I'm an artist. But for me, it was something like, I'm a beautiful woman. You know, it was something difficult to say. For me, it was something like people should call me that,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's something like that. But now, I'm...
Did you... I mean, because I know what you mean. It's, mm-hmm. it's kind of this imposter syndrome thing, right? Where you feel like, yeah, I'm not really an artist. I mean, the real artists, they're different from me, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But when people actually started calling you an artist, could you accept that? Or were you still feeling like, nah, I'm not really that? Like,
I mean, I accepted it immediately. I was waiting for that moment. No, but I'm still... But now, the new challenge, am I a good artist or bad artist?
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, first, okay, you're an artist, but so what? You know, mm-hmm. if you... And then it's a successful artist or not? You know, it's always like something coming up.
But is there something like a good or bad artist to you? Because,
yeah,
I mean, successful or not successful, I totally get. But, I mean, good... I mean, there are so many famous artists where I just don't connect at all with the work.
At all, yeah.
And then there are other ones that nobody knows about where I'm just like, this is amazing. So, I mean, it's...
Yeah, but there's no such thing for me as a good or bad. I just mm-hmm. said it as a joke.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Yeah, you know, it's like really someone is good for you. There are also like many artists that I can't really understand, but... Sometimes is it also like, should we, like, do we have to understand what they're doing?
Or
if, I don't know.
I think it's like understanding or liking music. You can't like all types of music.
Exactly.
It's just not possible.
It's a matter of taste in the end.
Yeah. Taste, and I think also, like you said, understanding, because I mean, there's a lot of types of music where it's maybe even difficult to like in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Like, a lot of things like, maybe a lot of types of jazz, for example. In the beginning, it's just like, this is so chaotic. But then when you start to kind of listen to it a little bit more and understand like the nuances, then all of a sudden it makes sense and it becomes beautiful.
Yeah.
And I think with art, it's similar. A lot of art, you first have to approach slowly and then you kind of get a taste for it.
Exactly.
So it's work. It's work to get to like it, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah. And with your own art, I mean, we talked about it earlier. We talked also about Christoph Niemann, and I said that I see a lot of similarities there because mm-hmm. both of you use a lot of, wit, yeah, and puns, and in a very clever way that you repackage ideas and visuals. Like one of my favorite of your pieces is the Yesterday's Dreams, I think it is. Yesterday's Feelings
mm-hmm.
with the trash bag. Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. I love that one. And they are, when you look at them, they're so obvious and they're like simple ideas. Yeah. But I mean, you have to come up with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I always I'm always kind of jealous of a mind that is able to come up with these things. I'm not that witty, so. But do you think that's something you trained as well, or was your mind just always like that? That just stuff bubbled up. You see something and you have an idea for it.
I love shortcuts in the brain. Okay, the thing, I'm a really overthinker person. Mm-hmm. Like my mind works like really in a complicated way. Actually, I'm not a simple person. It's the other way. I'm a really complicated person with lots of contradictions. But when it comes to work, I like to simplify it. Like, as simple as possible, that I'm even jealous of it because I'm not that simple, you know? And it's always a challenge. And I always like these brains like Christoph Niemann, for mm-hmm. example. I'm a really big fan of his work and himself as well. He's a great human being and creative, really warm-hearted person. And Johan Koenig also told me once that he also sees similarities between me and him and also David Strickley. Of Shriggy's the humor, well, I think. Yeah, I'm also a really big fan of his art as well. I think it's just humor, and it's just the humor that I like to use and the humor that I like. And as I said, because I'm a really overthinker person, if I was being an artist, like doing everything super in a perfect way and overcomplicated way, I would have never been able to execute anything. So that's why I stop thinking part. I stop overthinking and I'm just trying to let it go, you know, in my art, because I always say that I see my art as a form of self-therapy. So that's why this is something I really taught myself to be just simple and fast. And sometimes I even do things really in an imperfect way just to do it. Otherwise, I'm not a person to produce that many works, you know. I think this imperfectionism and also this simplicity keeps me execute more works that normally I could do, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I could explain it well.
No, I get it.
But,
I get it.
I just like skip overthinking part. Mm-hmm. This is but how I can do art.
But how do you do it? Because I mean, the part of the overthinking is, I mean, at least for me, I tend to be a little bit in mm-hmm. that direction as well, I would say. And it's very hard to just turn that off, right? I mean, you don't choose to overthink things.
Yeah.
So how are you?
But in my communication, in my daily communication with my friends, with my husband now, I'm super direct. Actually, it is also me. I'm super direct, and I like to be clever. You know, I like to keep the conversation also like clever. I have no tolerance towards these complicated minds, and so I think this is just what I do. It's really difficult to explain how I do it, but yeah. I think it is just me. Yeah. Yeah.
But maybe what you can explain is how the artist career, if I call it that, how that happened. Because I mean, there had to come a point where you're like we said, all the ideas you already used in your client work and stuff like that, I mean the same kind of ideas, but to actually create something without any client briefing, that's one thing, but then showing it to somebody, I mean, that's a different thing, right?
Yeah.
So how did that come about that you started showing these things?
And also, like, when I'm still like thinking about the answer of your question, I also, like, when I do art, I really like to touch people's brain and heart. And I think this is the way that I can do it. Like, this is my way of like touching your brain and heart in me being like really simple and clever and maybe funny, you know. So this is how I can reach people and also make them feel, ah, yeah, I thought so, I could have done that. So this is what I'm looking for from the viewer of my work. If they feel that, oh, I feel the same, so this is like, you know, it's like the biggest compliment. How I'm showing. Okay, here, the part of me being perfectionist, there I skipped this part, like being perfectionist, because if I had acted as a perfectionist, I wouldn't have shown anything to people. Mm-hmm. then, because then I was going to question if it is good enough. Even this podcast, you remember, I didn't want to do that because I'm like, if I'm going to say something stupid.
I had to convince you a little bit. Yeah,
you had to convince me because I'm super self-critical person and I'm so afraid of making a mistake and say something stupid. What if I say something stupid? But then I'm like, I can't listen. I'm not going to be able to listen to this podcast, I tell you, because then I'm going to hate myself. So I'm super, super self-critical person.
You're not alone in that, though. There are a lot of people who can't listen to themselves.
Yeah, and I can't also tolerate my own voice, whatever. So this Ezra, like super self-critical Ezra, was not going to be able to show her work, right, normally. But I just said, I'm just going to do it. And I didn't have many followers on Instagram. I just started posting things like however I like. And because I really saw it as a self-therapy, I was having really difficult times like a couple of years ago. And I was just like doing this therapy by making art and just showing people. And I just started getting really good reactions. And it was really nice. And I think these reactions are like, it's also like a bit like drug addiction. You want this good reactions again. Like a celery, that as we talked before. So I like these reactions that I inspired people, touched their hearts and brains. And it just gave me this motivation of like just keeping on showing and sharing them with people.
But so it was on Instagram that you first showed
yourself. First I started on Instagram and then I collected best works from Instagram and I opened my first solo show in Amsterdam. So nothing was new that I was showing there as a screen printed works that they used to be posts on Instagram before. So I was just like checking likes and what people like. Actually, it was something like a test.
Like market research.
Yeah, it was like a market research. I was like posting all the time and checking, if this gets likes or not, and if it is simple enough that people understand or not, and getting enough reactions, then I was able to print them and put them in a better level, like as an artwork, and then just exhibited them in Amsterdam.
So you started in Amsterdam, but for that first show, I always wonder how do these things happen, right? I mean, at first nobody asks you to give a show, right? So I assume you had to make it happen.
Yeah, the first show, it was in a Café Strike. I don't know how to pronounce it. And this cafe is like a bar, actually, in Amsterdam, in it's like Rosenthalerstrasse, but Dutch version, whatever. So it's on one of these main streets, and they are normally hosting street artists and doing these exhibitions like each month or every 2 months with an artist. They're just hosting them, and then you get their space to show your work, right? So then one of my friends from Amsterdam, he said he was also my collector. So he bought like 2 artworks from me. Now he has, I think, 3 or 4 works from me. So he said that I should actually show my work at that cafe. And he gave me this idea. Then maybe I sent him an email or he just connected me to this guy, like the creator guy from this cafe. And this is how it happened. So it was an idea from my friend Jesse. And then the second show came from Hamburg. Actually, it was a production company. From Hamburg. And they were also like collaborating with artists and giving their space as a gallery. And yeah, this is what I did also in Hamburg.
But
and then
you were still in Amsterdam?
No, I was in Berlin. Even when I did this show in Amsterdam, I was in Berlin.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was in Berlin, but yes, I was just like telling me that, hey, you should come to Amsterdam and do this exhibition. And the third one, you know, this Don't I Look Turkish exhibition, I did that one in Berlin, in Bold. And Bold, you know this PR agency from Berlin? And the owner, the founder, Jules, like Julia, she's really a good friend of mine now. She reached me out. She said she loves my work and she was going to open a new space and she wanted to open this new space with my exhibition. So she reached me out and then from the first day that we met, we fell in love with each other, with our brains, and we just, and I knew from the first day that I was going to do this exhibition around my identity and about these questions that I got asked.
Don't I look Turkish to you?
Yeah, the brilliant questions.
You should talk a little bit about that.
Yeah.
Because it's, I mean, that was, I don't know if I would call it your big break, but I mean, that really put you on the map.
It was a milestone of my life, I would say, my artist life, yeah. And the idea actually came from Christoph Arment. So he knew of my illustrations that I was doing around these questions that I was getting asked. And all these questions about Turkish stereotypes. And the funny thing about these questions, they're about stereotypes, but the questions themselves became stereotypes for us, like cliches. So,
cliches, you get asked them all the time.
Yeah, because like, do you eat pork? Okay, you know, like all the time. I mean, you can't ask Turkish people all the time if we celebrate Christmas or not. You know, it's like, but yeah, it's we were just like, we Turkish people here, but it's not just in Germany. I also got asked so many questions in Amsterdam, or my American friends are also ask me if I can read Arabic letters. So these questions about cliches became cliches. So then I called them the brilliant questions I got asked because I'm Turkish. So I already had made like 5 or 6 illustration works, and Christoph said, you really should do an exhibition with them, or you should just publish them somewhere. And he really encouraged me. Actually, to be honest, I didn't want to do something around my identity or something political. And I always say, I'm an apolitical artist. But if you're an artist, you're immediately political, right? And I just didn't want to do something about my Turkish identity. But he really encouraged me to do that, and Julia also liked the idea, so this is what we did, and it was a quite success because it touched so many people's hearts, including non-Germans and Germans, because they were like, oh, are you asking these questions? And the funny thing about this exhibition, I was showing 15 artworks and I sold 3 or 4 originals during the exhibition, and all buyers were German, or like people from Germany, you know. So this is something I really liked. It was not like, oh, am I asking this question, you know, like they didn't feel like they were criticized or something. They got the humor, they accepted the humor, they bought it, they supported me. So it's, or like non-Turkish people were wearing Don't I Look Turkish sweatshirts. It was really nice for me, you know. It was just so nice, yeah.
But I think humor is something that best works with surprise.
Exactly.
I mean, if you expect something and then you are surprised by the actual outcome, I mean, that's when you just get this gut laugh, you know, from your belly, and not just this intellectual laugh. So I think it makes sense that Germans bought the art, because when you think you are asking a sensible question, do you eat pork as a Turkish person, because that says anything about your meat habits apparently, and you think that's a sensible question, and then somebody says, that was so stupid of you, but in a charming way.
Exactly.
Then you can laugh, and then you can actually realize it and change.
I think this is the power of humor.
Yes, exactly.
It is not like putting fingers on you, but it was like, come on, this is funny, don't do it again. And it's also like, also my style is, you know, that I'm trying to keep my style really childish and imperfect, I will do it a bit more imperfect style actually day by day, but you know, it's also not like serious illustrations and the brilliant questions I got asked. It was also more like really free illustration and typography style. I think it also helps the tone of voice of the illustrations. I think it also helped.
Yeah, that it's not so perfect, and a little bit more of a, you said, I think you used to wear childish. So
childish,
political
illustrations, like vectorial, you know, it was not.
But exactly
like
that makes it possible for you to be like, put some really hardcore stuff out there, basically.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
It's just like, oh, no, I'm not that serious.
One of them actually, you know, I also converted some of the questions into objects. Like, for example, do women have to wear a hijab in Turkey question? I printed that one on a silk scarf, like a hijab. Or do you drink alcohol on rakı glasses? You know, like this Turkish alcoholic And then due to pork, I also painted it on a plate. And now this hijab is going to be part of Misa. And yeah.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. So Jakob's, Johann's art fair.
Yeah. Misa, you know that they're like supporting this established or emerging artists. And yeah, I am part of their next group show. It's going to be in Köln, like from 15th of November. So this hijab is going to be part of the show.
That's cool. But I love it when there's this jump from two-dimensional artworks to all of a sudden it's in a more sculptural
object,
approach.
Yeah.
But then I think the highest thing is actually when you do it like that and you have things that you can actually use, like table plates and stuff like that. That because again, I think it's like the humor, it makes it approachable and it makes it just be
approachable
there.
Art, reachable art. So this is what I also, you know, did so many collaborations with fashion brands. Mm-hmm. So it's then wearable art. So the art that you can wear, use, this is something I like. And also, again, because I studied interior design and also I studied product design in Genoa, like in Italy for 6 months. Product design was already part of my discipline. And I also have the knowledge of like making something more three-dimensional. Mm-hmm. This is something I also like and I think I am not bad at. So I also started creating more objects. In this show also you have seen this mirror and also the clock that I created. Also the headstone.
Actually, it's
and
all
the carpet, actually, all
it's
of them.
All of them are actual objects.
I started doing on paper, but these paperworks became an objects and unique objects and collectors like it so much. I also have been asked to do more, but it's not because I'm doing it, because I really like working on the objects. And now I also did this Yesterday's Feelings sculpture, bigger also for Misa. And yeah, I think in the future, I'm planning to build even bigger objects and do a bit like play with more with different mediums. Mm-hmm. So this is what is exciting for me.
Yeah, and I think play is the perfect word
play,
for it.
Right? This is what I said.
Play, yeah. I think it's the perfect word.
Exactly.
It's so, because there is something so playful about it, and I'm almost jealous that is what you do, because I think I'm always too much in the thinking part and for that. But there's something so playful about it, and in the end you have these things that are lighthearted, but that in the same way they carry so much meaning, and they can carry so much different meaning for different people, and also because you use words actually it makes it very approachable for everybody.
Yeah,
it's not so high-minded. You don't have to study to understand them.
Exactly, and it also talks. Let's say, for example, this headstone. What will people think? What do you get from it? Like, how does it make you feel? For example, so I'm just asking you, because then I will tell you the story behind it.
For me, it's like. It makes me think about if this was the end of my life, how important was it for me what other people thought, and how much did I actually just lead my life?
Yeah. I mean, the good thing about this, it talks to everyone, people in Turkey, people in Germany, people in like all over the world. But actually, the basic idea for that work was, you know, I was raised in Turkey. Obviously, as a Turkish girl in a small town, and my family was really, really, is still really conservative and religious. So apart from Islamic roots that I was like being raised, I was also having these questions all the time from my grandmother, from my father, what will other people think? What will other people think that Nevzat, my father's name, Nevzat's daughter would do? I had to hide from them that I had a boyfriend. Even like having a boyfriend was something that I couldn't share with my family when I was young, because then what their neighbors would think, you know? Like, it was this small conservative family and town. That's why this question touched so many women also in Turkey when I first used it as a, just an illustration in a collaboration that I did with Les Benjamins. But of course it says also something else to you, because also in our regular lives we care so much about what other people will think. But actually this has a little bit deeper meaning than that, I mean, mm-hmm. for me. But it doesn't matter. Everyone sees and reads it in a different way. This is what I like about it. It doesn't need to be like 100% understandable, but at least it touches you in some way. And yeah, this is what I like about it.
Yeah, and again, I don't think you can actually, with art, you can never transport 100% your intention.
Yeah, exactly. And I think this is also something I should also a bit go away from, because then it's a bit too direct and it's a bit too much. Because I should leave something for the viewer to take for themselves, you know? I think this is something I should work on, to be honest. Because otherwise it's a bit too... how can I say? It's a bit too direct, and it's not something that the viewer can have something for themselves. It's not something I really want to do in the future. But I want to keep it a bit more open.
But can you tell me an example of one of your works where you think it's too direct?
Too direct. For example...
Because most of the things, when I think about what you do, there's...
For example, people. You know this people work? Like, it's like handshaking illustration. Mm-hmm. Two hands are shaking, but the hands are doing middle finger.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
So, for example, that one. Mm-hmm. First, I made this illustration and wrote people are people. Then I was like, wow, this is a brilliant illustration, brilliant text. And then I said, yeah, maybe. And then I printed it again for another another exhibition. Then I said, yeah, people are people. It's a bit too much explaining. Maybe I just write people. This and people, perfect. And then for Plevneli, a gallery that represents me now from Istanbul, I was sending them a work, like for a group show. Then I said, they like that illustration. And I said, I want to do a new version with it. And I just also killed people, because then it's already, because the illustration is simple and really open enough that you get it, that it's people, you know, like it's. So I also killed the text in the work, and it's just illustration work now. So this is what I want to achieve. Mm-hmm. Because it's already... Because I think if you need to explain something, maybe it's not good enough. This is how I see art and also design. I think you shouldn't explain much. It should be already there. And it's also okay if someone doesn't get what I really mean. So this is the beauty of art, I think. So this is what I am trying to do more.
Yeah, I get it. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are a few works where you can reduce it like that. With others, I mean, you can't. With the tombstone, there has to be something on it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But, yeah, with that illustration, mm-hmm. I mean, that works by itself. That's true. But maybe that's also the advertising baggage that you carry, that you always have to put words.
Exactly. But I want to keep this communication art, like playing with words, maybe even more. But for example, one of my favorite works, this Mountains, Trees, Rivers series, because it's just mm-hmm. stupid. There is no really deep meaning behind them. It's just mountains, trees, rivers. And it's just like visualization of mountains by using typography. This is something I'm like, yeah, I want to do more this kind mm-hmm. of works, because it's more open. And Johan Koenig said once, I think it's amazing, people want to buy works that they want to hang on their walls. They are not looking for really deeper meanings. You know, like I do this art, it's amazing, but if people want to have them on their walls, you know, so this is, it is another thing.
Yeah. Yeah. If you do any kind of artistic work, there's a... I had a conversation once with Susanne Haller, or Lai now, she's married now. And she has a cycling brand, fingers crossed. And I think she's also a great artist, but it's not like her main thing. And I think she really does it on the side. But she said she sees her own artwork as decoration artwork, mm-hmm. yeah? And she said it in a way where felt like she's totally fine with that. Yeah, I mean, it's she just does it because it's the way she does it. She thinks it's beautiful. And mm-hmm. I think art, most art has two sides to it, and one of is the aesthetic, and the other is the meaning and how you weigh it. You know.
Yeah, this is not something I would. I love clever art, and mm-hmm. I want to be part of this clever art. Mm-hmm. So I'm a big fan of, for example, Anne Green Drexet Dio, for example. Mm-hmm. So this is art that I'm jealous of, you know? I'm not jealous of like decorable art. Like, of course, there are some artists that I love their work so much. They're beautiful. I would like to hang them on my wall. But it's not something I'm jealous of. I'm like, yeah, this is fine. It's amazing. But I'm not jealous of that works. So I want to do works that I'm like, fuck, I wish I had done that, which is clever art. In general, it's like that. Maybe it's going to change in the future. I don't know. But I want to keep it this way. Yeah. I want to really touch people's brains more, you know? So this is what I like. But I can do it in a more subtle way. So this is the challenge that I am in.
Mm-hmm. But I love that on your website, you show some of your commercial projects.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And even though you are moving more towards the art, mm-hmm. but the stuff that you chose to show, and I think that's something people need to understand. If you're a designer or an artist or whatever, the stuff you put on your website, you curate that. Yeah. I mean, you decide what's been shown. It's not like you put everything on there.
No, not at all.
Yeah, exactly. And the things you did put on there are very much in that vein. Like, when you said you wanted to reduce it to the minimum, I mean, I immediately thought about that Coca-Cola bottle that wasn't the bottle.
Yeah, this iconic bottle. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's a really good example. Yeah, you know, like at this Forward Festival, I was like I added an extra part of my talk. There, actually, I am showing that I don't see much difference between this Coca-Cola work, between this and before feedback, after feedback work, mm-hmm. for example. It's also like this magic and simplicity. It's just simple. It's just something like, I could have done that, right? So yeah, exactly. You can see that it is still Ezra, you know. So this is what I like to keep also when I do works as a designer.
Do you ever get annoyed by that I could have done that thing, or do you
no, not at all. It is a compliment for me, mm-hmm. because they didn't do it.
Yeah, that's exactly the point. People never realize it's not about,
sorry, I have done it before.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's also like someone also asked me in an interview, it was a really good question, Ezra, like in Istanbul, you do something like your art looks super simple, what if someone does something like that, like one day, like the same illustration in a really simple style like you did? And I said, yeah, of course they can do it, but they should do it in a persistent way and like in a regular level. It's like also Christoph Niemann, he's just doing it like all the time. It's not like one day he just created this banana horse image, mm-hmm. like just by an accident. He's just keeping on doing it.
Yeah, he's
so doing this is important. Of course someone can create something like, let's say this, Coca-Cola work or this before feedback, after feedback, once they can do it, but they are going to do it like in a regular base. So it is important. Persistence is really important to create your own signature.
Especially if you do work like that, that in theory, everybody could do.
Yeah, they can do, but maybe one or two times then.
Yeah.
If they do it in a regular base, then perfect. Yeah, then yeah. They're really good at doing it. So it's great.
I talked exactly about that with Sarah Illenberger just recently, mm-hmm. who's also been at Forward Festival with you. So you probably know her pretty well.
Of course. She's amazing. And we also became friends.
Yeah.
I love her brain a lot as well.
And I mean, she has that problem quite a lot, that a lot of her stuff gets copied, like straight up copied, because they are so simple in the execution.
Yeah.
But you have to have the idea.
Exactly.
That's the magic.
Yeah, they can do it once, like Sarah. But then it's like they do something like Sarah Illenberger. It's not like, you know, it's not them.
Mm-hmm.
Then for me, it's a compliment.
Yeah.
And sometimes people are showing their works that, I got inspired by you. I just like it. For me, it's like I'm inspiring people. And if they keep on doing that and even in a better level, I mean, perfect.
Yeah, I also always think that there's always two types of art that an artist does. And one is the individual piece, mm-hmm. one artwork that you create. But then there's also the whole body of work that you have. And I think that has a... I mean, this sounds really abstract there, but if I imagine 20 or 30 of your things, yeah, I mean, I won't see them specifically, yeah, but I have a feeling of what they're going to look like, what the textures are and all mm-hmm. that stuff. And if that is coherent and makes one piece, I think that's, for me, even the bigger piece of art that comes out, like mm-hmm. a whole life's work in the end. I think that is the fantastic thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's important.
I think that is a great point to end this, actually.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Ah, now it's done. I even don't know how we started. I'm
very happy that I managed to convince you in the end to actually sit down.
You're a professional.
No, I'm just,
and
I'm
obviously
not,
I'm not.
I'm not a professional. I'm just very persistent.
Yeah, persistent. As we said, perfect.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you so much as well.
Just like every week, I have a few suggestions for what you could listen to next. If you'd like to hear another interview in English and also stay within the art world, I suggest my conversation with Andrea Lissoni, the artistic director of Haus der Kunst in Munich. That was episode 35. And somebody who got mentioned a few times during my conversation with Ezra was the art dealer Johann König. I had met Johann in the fall in his gallery, St. Agnes, a former church built in the brutalist style and one of my favorite buildings in the world. And I can tell you, Johann is just as impressive as his building. That was episode 47. And by the way, that's in German. Oh, and we also mentioned Sarah Illenberger in this talk. Sarah is an illustrator originally from Munich, but now also lives in Berlin. And funnily enough, Ezra, Johann, as well as Sarah, have been speaking at Forward Festival in Berlin last year. It's a small world, I guess. That's episode 55 and also in German. And next week, I have a photographer on the show who started out in sneakers, but now roams through nature, but still decked out in vintage North Face. Until then, have a fantastic week. Das war's für heute. Falls du gerade eine von den älteren Folgen hörst, ist es gut möglich, dass du jetzt ein zweites Outro hörst. Lass dich aber nicht von mir verwirren. Ich bin gerade dabei, ein paar Änderungen zu machen. Und dafür muss ich 150 Folgen neu schneiden und nochmal uploaden. Du kannst dir wahrscheinlich vorstellen, dass das ein kleines bisschen dauert. Falls du mich und die Show supporten möchtest, gibt's dafür ein paar Möglichkeiten. Auf patreon.com/svenzaro gibt's jede Woche Bonusmaterial, exklusiv nur für Supporter. Und das für nur ein paar Euro im Monat, mit denen du mir helfen kannst, ohne den Hype noch lange, lange für dich weitermachen zu können. Es hilft natürlich auch immens, wenn die Show wächst, und dazu kannst du deinen Teil beitragen, indem du deinen Kollegen und Kolleginnen davon erzählst. Freunde, Familie, du weißt am besten, für wen das noch was sein könnte. Und zu guter Letzt, falls du es noch nicht gemacht hast, bewerte die Show jetzt gleich mit 5 Sternen in deiner Podcast-App. Im Newsletter gibt es übrigens jede Woche völlig kostenlos inspirierende Tipps von meinen Gästen und mir. Den kannst du auf ohnehinhype.substack.com abonnieren. Und alle Links findest du, wie immer, direkt auch hier in der Beschreibung und natürlich auf ohnehinhype.com. Im Archiv gibt es noch eine Unmenge anderer Gespräche. Unter anderem waren schon mit dabei Stefan Sagmeister, Mirko Borsche, Paula Schör, Mike Mirie, Jeremy Format, Jonas Lindström, Mathilde Mutant, Olaf Heine, Eike König, Erich Spiegermann und. Scroll einfach mal durch. Wir sind bei über 150 Folgen, wie gesagt. Und um ehrlich zu sein, kann ich selber kaum fassen, dass ich das Glück hatte, mit so vielen inspirierenden Menschen sprechen zu dürfen. Vielen Dank an Dominik Huber und Marc Kappeler von Moiré. Von denen stammt nämlich die neue Hausschrift der Show, und die heißt GT Pressura. GT steht übrigens für Grilly Type, über die Schrift zu mir kam. Und auch nochmal vielen Dank an Tobias Rechsteiner fürs Vermitteln. Der größte Dank geht aber natürlich an dich fürs Einschalten, fürs Zuhören und für deinen Support. Und wir hören uns dann hoffentlich nächste Woche wieder.